I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In. My guest today is Isabelle Mansouhi, a professor of neuroepigenetics in the medical faculty of the University of Zurich and the Department of Health Science and Technology of the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology, Zurich. Specializing in neuroepigenetics and molecular psychiatry, Dr. Mansouhi is doing cutting-edge research using mice to separate nature from nurture in how the effects of trauma, environmental stress, and even diet can be biologically passed down to subsequent generations. Isabelle Mansouhi, bienvenue à Delving In.
Merci pour votre invitation.
Yeah, I think that's all the French we'll use just in because of my audience is not French speaking, and it's been about 40 years since I've been using much French. So, okay. So let's start with the most basic question, which is what is epigenetics? And I have to say that I find this topic very fascinating. I'm a psychologist, so it's very relevant to my work. I've worked with both in the school system and also in private practice. And I know that it's a very big controversy within psychology and psychiatry, where does mental illness come from? And this is a factor that I think is so underappreciated and so, but anyway, please tell us, what is epigenetics?
Yeah, epigenetics itself is not that recent, because people in cancer or people working on cellular biology have been doing some epigenetics since 20, 30, 40 years. What's new about epigenetics is its inclusion in neuroscience and the consideration of its necessity or its importance for mental health. So what epigenetics is, it's an ensemble of mechanisms and factors which regulate the genome. So we classically think of the genome as the DNA strand, and that all the information is contained in the code, in the genetic code. That's only partial truth. The reality is that this code is regulated. We can take the analogy of a piece of music, and to read the piece of music, so the piece of music would be the genetic code, but you need instruments and players to interpret this piece of music. And epigenetics is the instrument and the players. So you can have, there are multiple, there are many different epigenetic factors which are on the genetic code, so on the DNA or around the DNA, and which regulate its activity, which determine whether genes are expressed to produce proteins or not. But they also regulate the structure of the DNA, because the DNA is not a linear structure. It has multiple 3D forms which change all the time, and epigenetic factors also change the shape of the DNA in addition to the activity.
Well, I love metaphors, and just to amplify on your analogy, if the relationship between genetic code and epigenetics is like music and the instruments and performers, I would say that maybe it's more like jazz than classical music, in the sense that the expression is regulated, so to speak, by what else is happening, not just among the players, but also in the audience. You know, the audience starts to get really excited about a particular riff in jazz, and the musicians respond, and they change the way they're playing somewhat. And so it's all very responsive.
Yes, absolutely. You are right to say this. And an audience, a quiet audience of classical music would be the equivalent of a quiet environment, and an excited audience would be an environment which changes all the time and which does contribute to modify the way the performers and the instruments play. Yes, that's a very good analogy. I agree.
And one thing I wanted to mention is in some of your papers, I was reminded that the sequencing of the human genome was completed in 2003, and it didn't yield the dramatic progress that was expected, particularly in medicine and the treatment of disease, that we thought once we had the genes mapped out, and it turned out there were only, 30,000 of them, it was fewer than expected, that tremendous medical progress would ensue, and it didn't. I mean, certainly there has been some progress, but not nearly as much dramatic progress as expected. And part of the reason for that is the complexity, by adding the epigenetic factors, the complexity is vastly, vastly greater. And you can't understand the genes without the interpreter, the epigenome.
Yes, that's exactly the case. And not only this, is that the genes themselves, so the coding part of the genome, is a very, very small proportion of the genome. It's 1 to 2%, while people were thinking initially that the DNA contains many more, the DNA sequence, the proportion of the DNA sequence dedicated to coding genes is much more important. And indeed, most of 98%, if not 99% of the genome is non-coding. So it's regulatory sequences. So is it that sense that it was completely unexpected finding? And on top of this, a given gene, it's not like it's turned on or off. There are many, many nuances about this. It can be turned on a little bit or optimally. It can be turned on, but it has multiple options to produce, to be read and to produce an RNA, which is the copy of the DNA. So all these elements were not really considered when people were initially envisaging the results of the sequencing of the DNA. Yeah, they thought that you read the book and you understand everything. But it's like the book was read, was sequenced, but it doesn't make any sense when you read it. So you need a lot more to be able to understand it.
And my understanding is that at first the thought was that all this other genetic material, the 97, 98%, was maybe junk left over from evolution and didn't do anything. And that turns out to not be the case at all.
Yes, that was a very strange, I mean, a posteriori, it's really strange that any decent biologist would even suggest such name. So I don't know why indeed people even used it, did not question this statement more. But yes, it's true that people just ignore. You know, there was a domination of genetics that people thought it's really the genetic code only which counts. The rest does not count. Maybe that in a couple of years we realize that it's the other way around, actually, that the non-coding genome may be more important than the coding genome.
So you could say that epigenetics is a type of humility training, that, you know, that we shouldn't get too full of ourselves, that we understand it all and we're on the verge of having almost a complete theory. And I think we've done that in other things, like in physics. We talk about the theory of everything is on the brink, you know, where if we'll understand the most fundamental things. And back in the 18th century, there was a thought that it was the whole universe was mechanistic and we'll understand all the properties and then the rest will just be details. And I think we're finding out that there's layers and layers and layers of complexity.
No, that's very true. We need to have lots of humility, because it's like a huge mountain or even multiple mountains ahead of us, and we simply don't understand very little of the epigenetics at the moment. All these genetic domination may also have been circumstantial, because people had to convince themselves, to convince the community, and maybe also to convince funders that sequencing the genome is absolutely necessary. It required massive effort, massive investment. So maybe there was a little bit of inflating the importance of the DNA sequence to reach the achievement of the sequencing. And some people just forgot about the fact that it's only a code.
Yeah, in English, we call that hype. H-Y-P-E, hype. I don't know if you're familiar with that word.
Yeah, of course. It is indeed a hype. It's a hype which, to me, lasted too long. And even today, there are still people who believe that genetics runs the world and that epigenetics is just anecdotal, in particular in epigenetic inheritance. So there is, it's very much engraved in the mind of biologists that genetics is the most important thing to care about. So I think it has also not served epigenetics very well. I think it slowed down progress in epigenetics, because, I mean, it really distracted from putting also thought into epigenetics. And this is unfortunate. It's only now that we realize that, well, we cannot understand complex disease with just the genetics. We need to also understand epigenetics.
So Ismail, how did you become interested in epigenetics in general and also in your specific area?
I worked for many years on memory, or on forgetting exactly. And forgetting or memory or brain processes are addressed from a cellular or network level or from a molecular level. And my interest was really, what are the molecular determinants of forgetting? And in this search of the molecular players of memory, we came down to the genome and the epigenome. It's when I first started to be interested in epigenetics, because that was also new, not only in relation to heredity, but 20 years ago or 15 years ago, epigenetics in the brain and its importance for brain functions and memory started to emerge. I really came from a different perspective. I've always been interested in behavior and in mental diseases, but I'm a molecular biologist by training. So these interests just converge onto DNA and epigenetics, which was a totally new field. Epigenetic inheritance, just the concept, was not even discussed 20 years ago. So if you are interested in mental diseases, you know that mental diseases are inherited. They run in families. It's not clear, at least genetics cannot explain everything. So little by little, I joined, you know, my research on memory, my molecular background, my interest for epigenetics, and my interest for mental health into a common question of epigenetic inheritance. But I started to work in this field or on this question 20 years ago, on the side, because it was almost impossible to get funding. I don't think any grant proposal would have been approved. So it's little by little that we built this research line, we developed a mouse model, and that we started slowly. But it took a lot of time to really mature the idea and have sufficiently powerful tools to really address the questions we wanted to address.
What are the advantages and disadvantages of using an animal analog, in your case, using mice? What's useful about it? What's helpful? And what makes it maybe somewhat difficult to generalize?
What's extremely useful is the availability of, so it's a model which has many features which are similar to human. Mice are able to memorize objects, to memorize places, and to have social interactions. Behaviorally, there are many things which are similar to human. They can also express symptoms which are similar to human. A mouse can be anxious, a mouse can be depressed, a mouse can have cognitive decline. So it's phenotypically, it has many similarities to human. Major advantage is that mice can also provide tissue. We can look into the brain, into liver, into blood, which is very limited in human. In human, you can do imaging in brain, but you cannot do any molecular analysis in brain. So that's one of the advantages, that tissues to conduct molecular analysis are available. And with respect to epigenetic inheritance, when you want to look at multiple generations, it has a huge advantage of having a generation time which is much shorter than human. A female gestation is 3 weeks, and a mouse becomes adult within 2 months, 2 to 3 months. So everything is much more rapid than humans. So if you want to look at an effect of environment on 2, 3 generations or 4 generations, it's doable in a decent amount of time.
The lifespan is, what, about 3 years or so?
Maximum, in more 2 years, 2.5 years maximum.
So you can have great, 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 great grandchildren of and so on of the mouse.
We had a study with the sixth generation.
Wow.
After trauma.
Let's talk about the implications for human trauma and for recovery and resilience. This is getting into, I think, the heart of the interview, and you know, feel free to expound at some length here. I mean, this is kind of the reason why you're doing the research, the hope for the, understanding what happens in humans, obviously, I mean, it's a mouse model. It's not that, I mean, of course, maybe you love your mice because you work with them so much. But the point of the whole research is to understand people.
Yes, exactly. It's to gain knowledge into this form of heredity, which is not understood at all, the epigenetic heredity. So our motivation is really a gain in understanding, but also you are right in trying to gain knowledge into diseases which affect humans, diseases or just states, normal features of human, which can be transferred across generations. So the concept is really novel, and it's very challenging, and it just really re-questions the idea that genetics is the only determinant of phenotypes.
So the analogy that I often think of is that the epigenetic is kind of like switches. If you think of the genes as being a series of toggle switches with on-off, that it's the epigenetics, it's the environment, and the response to the environment that turns the switches on and off, you know, in response to the environment. And what's been surprising is that these switches, or the settings of the switches, can be passed down, which is really surprising. Because I think originally the thought was that when the germ cells are created, the sperm and the egg, that those settings are erased. But it turns out that only some of them are erased. I guess we're still just beginning to understand why some are erased and some are not erased. But that's the thing. So if, let's say, I was in some kind of catastrophe, let's say the town was hit by a volcano and I managed to survive, that the stress of that, the stress reaction that happens in my epigenome can be passed down to my children. And that's the big surprise.
Yes, and there is still a misconception that everything is erased or reprogrammed. This is true for one type of epigenetic mark, which is DNA methylation, and to some extent also histone modifications, which are other types of epigenetic factors. But this does not take into consideration the fact that there are other factors which contribute to keep a trace or memory of previous experience, which are RNA. We know RNA. We know that RNA also are also involved. There could be other factors that we have not discovered yet. So it's true that some of the epigenetic factors are reprogrammed to some extent, although in human germ cells, in human sperm, for instance, 15% of the chromatin or of the marks, of the proteins which carry marks, remain during fecundation and after fecundation or during sperm formation, which means that there is a lot of, the erasure is really not complete, and there is a lot of possibility to keep memory or traces of previous experiences. So the fact that multiple epigenetic factors are likely involved, multiple epigenetic factors in germ cells are likely involved, really opens, it gives a much more complicated picture than just DNA methylation or modification of protein histones, which people thought are the major reason for epigenetic inheritance to not exist. But now it's really confirmed that erasure, reprogramming is not an obstacle to epigenetic inheritance anymore.
There are many factors with these epigenetic settings. So if I have one traumatic experience, that's not going to be probably as big of an impact as two, assuming they're of the same severity. And I imagine that's something that you study with your mouse model, the different types of trauma and change.
We study chronic trauma. So trauma which happens regularly, in our case daily, and for a long period of time. In the case of our mouse model, it lasts for 2 weeks. 2 weeks during postnatal development, so one day after birth for the first 2 weeks of life, so which is a very critical time window, because many things happen during development. The brain is shaping up, and it's the environment is starting to the pup is starting to interact with its environment. So developmental processes very much influenced by the environment during that stage. So that's a very severe trauma, and trauma which has multiple elements, because we separate the pups from the mother unpredictably. So there is separation, emotional absence, neglect, unreliability of being nurtured, unreliability of being with the mother. So there are really multiple traumatic things which are put together, and whose consequences are quite important on the mental and physical health.
And so this would include things like postpartum depression in the mother, and how that affects not only the baby mouse, but also the children of that baby mouse, correct?
Yes, depression during after birth or during rearing of pups is part of the element, although in mice, females are very good mothers. Even if they are depressed, they provide very good maternal care. It's a highly developed innate feature in female mice. So it's not exactly the amount of maternal care which is perturbed, but it's the reliability and the quality of the maternal care which matters. But they are, the pups are also separated from their mother, so there was this deprivation time, which and really the unpredictability is a very important factor. The fact that the pups, they don't know when they are going to be taken care of.
So in other words, the experimenter is manipulating the availability of the mother, like taking the mother away, for instance, and then putting the mother back and then taking away. Is that what we're talking about?
Yes, exactly. The mothers are taken away 3 hours per day, any time during the day. It's unpredictable. And during this separation, the female are also exposed to a stress. So during the 3 hours of separation, they are not only are away from their pups, but anytime during these 3 hours, they're also exposed to a small stressor, so which amplifies the overall amount of distress on them.
I know we talked about this a little bit when we spoke a few weeks ago, and I just wanted to mention it, not to necessarily go into it in any depth, but some of our listeners may be upset to hear how the mice are being treated. But I think the view that's taken by you and by other researchers is that while that's true, it's very important for human beings to understand these processes, and this is the only way to do it. There really isn't a substitute.
Yeah, exactly. It's essential that such research is done, because without such animal model, it will not be able to not be possible to understand the mechanism of how the environment, how traumatic stress influences mental health and physical health. And also, we can reassure the audience that all the experimentation in animals is extremely regulated, very tightly regulated. So it's not like we are mistreating mice. I mean, we conduct these experiments under very strict rules, which are examined by the veterinary authorities. So it's something which is well framed, and we do only the minimum.
And presumably, the mice in the wild, I imagine, have a lot of fear ordinarily as they're trying to stay away from predators.
Of course, and so they're probably even more exposed to a threat and to danger. Yeah, in our facility, we take very good care of them. We are also working on how to reverse the negative consequences of trauma. And we use environmental enrichment to do this. So it's not like we only traumatize our mice. We also expose our mice to very nice environments to see whether we can reverse or correct the negative effects of traumatic experiences. And this type of manipulations you cannot do in humans. You cannot take a child, mistreat the child, and then put the child in a nice family and see what happens. Although someone, somehow, in New York City in the 60s did this. I don't know, you may know this case of this orphanage.
Yes, I have heard about that case, yeah.
So this orphanage was systematically separating twins or triplets.
Yeah, there was actually a recent documentary about the triplets and finding out that they were part of this experiment, and that's why they didn't know about each other until they accidentally ran into each other as adults. Yeah, quite amazing. Let's shift now to talking about methodology, because I think that's just really fascinating how it's possible to separate nature from nurture using these studies. Because, you know, in humans, we very often have correlational research, or at best, we have natural experiments. But for ethical reasons, we can't do random assignment, except with this one person in the 60s. So how is it done with mice? And in particular, could you explain about how the fathers, the sperm from the fathers is the kind of the genetic material of choice, or the epigenetic material of choice for methodological reasons?
There are different elements to answer this question. First is that we use mice which are called to be isogenic. So they all have the same DNA. So there is no genetic variability in between the mice. So we get rid of this heterogeneity and focus only on epigenetics. They all have the same genome. So if something is different among them, if some mice with all the same genome, it's as if we were using only monozygotic twins or real twins in human, and we expose them to two different environments. Exactly what these people have done in the 60s, indeed. So if you see a difference in individuals who have been exposed to a rich and nice environment with lots of social interactions and nice intellectual environments, and you see a difference with someone who grew up in a poor environment, being neglected by the parents and being humiliated, you see a difference in mental health, then it says that it has to be epigenetic if the genetic code is the same. So that's one of the beauty also of the mice. And regarding germ cells or sperm cells from mice, we can also do a lot with this. We can extract some components of the sperm cells and inject them into an egg, into an oocyte, generate an offspring, and see what are the effects. If the components we extract from sperm are extracted from sperm of a male who has been traumatized, and we do the same from a male who has not been traumatized, and we generate an offspring artificially with injection and then transplantation of the oocyte into a pseudo-pregnant females, then we can look at the effect and draw very firm conclusions. Yes, that's the component in the sperm that is responsible for the phenotypes. And that's exactly what we did with RNA. We could demonstrate that RNA in sperm cells carries traces of previous experiences and is partly responsible for the transmission to the following generation. We did this a couple of years ago, almost 10 years ago, actually, with RNA from sperm of traumatized mice. And since then, in the epigenetic inheritance community, there are other people who apply this technology to test RNA from sperm from mice which were had a nutritional insult, like a high-fat diet, low-protein diet, or bisphenol A, different manipulations. So it has now become a general concept that sperm RNA plays a very important role, transmission to the following generation. And this can only be done in mice.
And then the fathers are not in part of the baby mice environment, right? So it's just the epigenetic change biologically. And then the father, whether it's a traumatized father or a non-traumatized father, they're not part of the environment of the mouse growing up. And that's isn't that the way that you separate the nature from nurture problem?
Exactly. That's another big difference and big advantage of mice is that fathers don't take part into the rearing and the raising of the pups. So there is no influence. And it's only the mother. And in this case of this manipulation with sperm RNA, we use controlled females. So maternal care is completely normal. The only difference is that the pups come from an oocyte which has been injected with a sperm RNA. So we can exclude many confounding factors and thus provide causal evidence that sperm RNA is the carrier of the messages from one generation to the next.
So let's talk about a specific example. So you have sperm from a traumatized father, and then what is exhibited by the pups as they grow up compared to normal?
The pups resulting from the injection of sperm RNA?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. They have risk-taking behavior. They have similar phenotype, similar symptoms as the males, as the father from which the RNA was extracted from. So males, which themselves have been exposed to this form of trauma, maternal separation, unpredictable maternal separation, they are depressed, they are anxious, they are antisocial, they have problems with memory, and they have metabolic alterations, glucose dysregulation, insulin dysregulation, and dyslipidemia. The pups, which originate from eggs, oocytes, which have been injected with sperm RNA, we show that they have risk-taking behaviors as well as depressive-like behaviors. Also, glucose and insulin metabolic alterations. Some phenotypes are not reproduced, though. We did not test all of them, but what we can say is that some of the phenotypes induced by traumatic experiences are recapitulated in these animals, arising from oocyte injected with sperm RNA.
So to put it in human terms, it would be as if it's a child who is not able to focus very well, not able to manage his or her own behavior, probably getting into trouble at school, probably difficult to handle at home as well. In the school system, of course, we have special programs or at least special supports for such children. It's very expensive monetarily, but it's also very expensive emotionally in terms of time. It requires much more time for the teacher and much more time for the parent. It's what you might call a high needs child. But what's really fascinating about this is that with the mice, unless a subsequent generation or even that generation is exposed to an optimal environment, an enriched environment, which I understand for a mouse would be a lot of exercise wheels and more room to run around, a big cage, you know, kind of mouse heaven, you know, and that can reverse some of this. And, you know, in a child, it would be, I guess, you know, since we can't really do this as an experiment, but if a child happens to be adopted by an optimal set of parents who are able to not only handle the behavior, but actually help to communicate and teach self-control and feeling of being loved and nurtured and belonging to the family, that a lot of that is reversible as well. But if it's not reversed, whether in the mouse or in the human, it can go on and on for a number of generations, which is really fascinating. So in other words, because the great-great-great-grandfather was traumatized, the descendants can exhibit some of the same behavior, and it's not genetic in the sense that it's fixed, it's epigenetic, and it's reversible through an optimal environment. And this is really very different, I think, than the way most people think about mental health or how psychiatry, whether here or in the West, explains these things.
Yes, absolutely. You're absolutely right. However, the extrapolation to human is still a little bit premature. This has not been really demonstrated, the fact that it can be transmitted across multiple generations. We have solid evidence in mice. We still need to demonstrate that's true in humans. But it's very difficult to demonstrate that's true in humans because of all the confounding factors, the genetic heterogeneity, the social environment. Obviously, if you have parents who are risk-taking, depressed, and who have problems, cognitive impairments, the risk that you are not raised properly is quite high, and that may be resulting from this. We still cannot make firm statements that this is also the case in humans. But I agree with you that even the possibility that this can happen changes the perspectives and changes the way to treat or to approach mental health. And I think one problem with depression, for instance, is the guilt. People feel very guilty because they, you know, it's not good to appear depressed because it's as if you have failed your life. But perhaps people should think differently and say, I did nothing wrong. Maybe it's something I inherited from my parents or my grandparents. It's just as if you, you know, you are diabetic because there is diabetes in the family. So it's it can help people, I think, as you say, to approach the question differently.
Right, but if it's epigenetic and not genetic, let's say your tendency for depression, let's say if it turns out, and I appreciate your scientific spirit that you're not, you know, you're being careful not to overstate what we know. But if it turns out to be true that it's more epigenetic than genetic, then that implies that it's more easily reversed and that there may be optimal, whether it's optimal kinds of treatment or just optimal kinds of experience. You know, so for instance, if someone is fortunate enough to understand who to be in a relationship with for their primary relationship, and it's with someone who's a really healthy, nurturing person, that can go a long way to reversing a lot of these epigenetic changes.
I fully agree. This is very true. What is needed, I think, in human also is that is more child psychiatry, because there are many symptoms which go unnoticed in children. And many symptoms start to really be visible when the people need to be to become independent in their life and need to manage their life alone, which is early adulthood. Until then, you know, children may just cope more or less well, but they have not been treated. And maybe if you start noticing these risk-taking behaviors, depression and antisocial behaviors in adulthood, one can wonder whether it's still time, it's not too late to reverse. So I think there is also a very important element of diagnosis or identifying the risk that people, children, may, due to their past or to the past of their parents, may be at risk to develop these diseases, and then not wait until the disease phenotypes are expressed to act. Maybe act much earlier in child development.
Yeah, I actually did an interview recently with David Olds, who does intervention starting no later than the 26th week of pregnancy with at-risk mothers. And I think it does exactly what you're talking about. I was wondering if I could lend you my crystal ball for a moment. And if you could, and if you can, talk about what kind of studies there might be in the future that would help to more definitively show the connection in humans, you know, because we have these methodological problems because of ethics that we can't do what we do to mice. So what kind of things would be looked for verifying the hypothesis that what you're studying in mice actually is quite present in humans as well?
I think we first need to identify markers which are relevant, which are linked to the symptoms, and markers which are reliable and which can be easily identified in easily accessible body fluids. So it's a crystal ball, but that's something for the next couple of years, because it's something absolutely reachable that, owing to the work in animal models, that we could look at blood, urine, saliva, sperm, all the elements or biological fluids which are available to us non-invasively, and grow and look, be able to identify epigenetic marks or factors, traces of which are linked to an increased susceptibility to diseases. That's said in one sentence, but it means many, many different things, because factors, you know, the link between a factor and the risk is something very, it's a notion which is very loose, because you may have, we don't know, first of all, we don't know what are the genes which are responsible for depression or for antisocial behavior, so for risk taking. We hardly know which brain area is involved into these behaviors. So we first have to understand what are the genes, what are the mechanisms of depression, for instance, before being able to identify these factors, I think. So, and the factors, once they are identified in mice, we need to confirm that they are also valid in humans. And, you know, because the type of trauma, the time when trauma was experienced, there are many, many elements which have to be taken into consideration.
So it's almost as if we need an epigenetic archaeologist, you know, someone who's going to look for the traces of these things, the markers.
That's a very good term.
And I think I'm understanding a little bit better now why you're called a molecular, while you're doing molecular psychiatry. So molecular psychiatry, in most instances, I think people would think about drug development, you know, for psychiatric drugs, for instance. But what we're talking about here is the molecular consequences of trauma and using that to understand how psychiatric problems evolve biologically, not because of genes so much per se, although genes could have something to do with it. It could be someone has a genetic vulnerability to depression, and then the epigenetics can bring that out or not. Although I think something like, I forget if it's either 1/3 or 1/6 risk if a parent is depressed, that a child will, their children will be depressed. And people often mistake that and thinking, oh, well, then that means it must mean it that much is genetic, when it really could be mostly epigenetic. We don't know. I'm speculating here. But it really opens up, I think, a lot of potential for hope. What I love about this topic is it gives a lot of hope for a much healthier future without necessarily relying on drugs. I mean, I don't know what your opinion is on psychiatric drugs, but they don't address epigenetics very well, I don't think.
No, absolutely. I mean, they treat some symptoms, but they don't treat the cause of the symptoms and the cause of the disorders. You know, psychotherapy cognitive behavior therapy, there are many, or shamanism, hypnosis. I mean, there are many approaches which help alleviate. It's just not known. I think that these type of treatments, they have not been really taken that seriously. I mean, many people use them, but wish it would be important to know, to gain more knowledge about what is the molecular consequence. There are so different types of treatment. For some people, even if they are severely affected, one or two sessions of psychological treatment would be enough, while other people may need 15 years of treatment. Some people can be cured with a religious type of approach. So everything is a little bit overwhelmed. So I think more research in this respect is needed.
Now, in my experience, and this is, you know, not based on necessarily very robust studies, although there have been some, it seems to me that the deeper the psychological problems, the more that the treatment depends on a really nurturing relationship between the therapist and the client, that learning that there's someone in the world who cares about them, who listens to them, who validates them. And I imagine that's somewhat true in mice too, that mice need not exactly the same kind of validation that a human needs, but need to feel secure with the other mice. If they're not, then it leads to all sorts of problems.
Absolutely. Neglect. Neglect is one of the causes of depression and unstable psychological, unstable psychological status, even in mice.
I wanted to ask you, presumably there are evolutionary advantages in passing down epigenetic settings that are altered by severe stress. And what might they be? Because, you know, it sounds so negative. I mean, being anxious or depressed or withdrawn or inattentive. I mean, all these kinds of things. And my guess is it has to do with short-term advantages that are not so advantageous on the long term. But could you talk about that? Why might, whether it's a mouse or a human, want to, quote unquote, pass down the new settings that have arisen because of stress, because of traumatic stress?
Well, I think first formulating it like this sounds like it's voluntary.
Right, right. Well, I had quotation marks.
Yes, I think it happens that the environment is perturbing hormonal homeostasis in the body, and that this induces alterations which are persistent enough in germ cells to be passed. Of course, it does not prevent anyone to think in evolutionary terms, but if you think of depression, you know, you can see both ways. It depends on the context. It depends on the time course, as you said. It may give a short-term advantage, which on the long term may not be maybe detrimental. But it also depends on the context. You know, depression. If depression involves social withdrawal, you isolate yourself when you are depressed. It's very negative in a social social society, in a society where human interactions are necessary. However, it's very useful to protect yourself from possible harm. So it's kind of a reaction to avoid further traumatic experiences by a peer. So it all depends on the circumstances and on the conditions. Indeed, being self-isolating due to depression may be positive ultimately, because it allows you to prevent any further assault. What we have noticed in our mice is that despite the fact that they are depressed, antisocial, risk-taking, they are more prone to cope with difficult situations, with challenging situations. We have different tasks where they are food or water deprived, and they need to understand a very complicated task requiring to understand a signal, wait in front of this signal until it's a light which has changed color, wait until the color changes a certain amount of time, you know, the color changes after 6 seconds, for instance, before going to a lever to get food or reward. So it's a difficult task. And the animals are of food or water deprived, so they are motivated to get this reward. And the mice which have been traumatized and their progeny, they better cope with this type of difficult or challenging situation. They are able to use a more efficient strategy, despite the fact that they are cognitively impaired. But they can mobilize energy and also a strategy to get more reward during this life-threatening situation where you are food and water deprived. So, you know, resilience is something which is very often observed in human as well. Indeed, if you look at who are the soldiers, people in the professional army, very often there are young men who are very courageous, very valiant, and they had a very difficult childhood. And indeed, if you have been exposed to a quite severe trauma or violent environment in your childhood, you can somewhat better cope or be more courageous or mindless, be less affected by further stress or dangerous situation. And risk-taking, that's exactly what we see in our mice. The risk-taking is increased, and indeed it's the phenotype which is transmitted the most. The fifth generation still show this risk-taking. So it's a very primitive kind of behavior, and it's the type of behavior which persists, which is transmitted the most.
So to draw an analogy to humans, it's as if, let's say, a child is coming to school from a neglectful or traumatizing environment or home, and they come to school, and instead of paying attention to the academic material, they're very attuned to the teacher's tone of voice, the noises in the hallway. I mean, they're ready to respond to danger. And because they also might be more prone to risk-taking, they actually can respond faster rather than think things through or be afraid, although they may be afraid for other reasons. But they're not tuned into what's considered important by the school, but they're tuned into what's important from either their experience or the parents' or grandparents' experience.
Yes, no, absolutely.
It's almost as if they're responding to a different environment than the rest of the kids.
Yes, absolutely. You know, the borderline personality disorder is a disease which reflects these symptoms very well. Borderline personality disorder patients, in most cases, have been exposed to violence in their childhood. Social, sexual abuse, physical abuse, and they have the combined symptomatology of depression, risk-taking, problems with their memory, antisocial behavior. Very often these people, they cannot really integrate into the society. They are not necessarily completely psychiatrically impaired up to a point to not function. They may function, but when exposed to a challenge or a difficult relationship, they cannot cope with this. And very often there are many borderline personality disorder people who self-mutilate, and many also commit suicide. So it's one of the diseases which is the best representative of the consequences of childhood trauma.
I wanted to ask you about a particular finding that I found really amazing, and it really speaks to the complexity of this whole field, if this is true, that I read somewhere that the epigenetic changes can go dormant. It's almost as if the settings are partially there, but not enough of the settings to make a particular behavior active. But then a few generations later, I'm talking about mice, I suppose, a few generations later, in response to a particular stress in the environment, all those other toggle switches suddenly turn on and the behavior changes. And the implications, and again, this is only implications, I know this is going beyond the science, but you know, if similar things happen in humans, it's as if someone was in a wartime situation and they're tremendously stressed, and then let's say two generations later, there's an optimal environment and the changes, epigenetic changes go away, but they don't go away completely. And then a couple of generations further than that, suddenly a child is reacting in an unexpected way that's a result of the trauma from many generations earlier.
Yes, no, that's very true. It refers to what you said earlier about the on-off state. I did not say anything at this stage, but that is exactly this. It's not only on-off, but there is this notion of priming that epigenetic factors, because they are very complex. Imagine, you know, that to open a door, you would need multiple keys and multiple complex keys, and that, you know, except if you have all the keys, the door will open. You may have only few keys which prime the door to be open, but you need all these additional things. So it's exactly like this indeed. And, you know, when you talk to patients, there are many, many, many people who report. I had so many testimonies of people even traveling for far away, coming to my office to express themselves and say that they were struggling with depression or with a severe mental illness always until they started really to dig into their past and try to understand what went wrong in their life and realized and learned about, you know, the parents' or grandparents' experience. It's all maybe correlative, but there are so many people who discover that, you know, their parents or grandparents were deported during the war, or there was an infanticide in the family. So it's maybe just fortuitous and correlation again, but I believe that there is probably a trace.
Very suggestive. All right, so this may be the last question, and I don't know to what extent you'll be able to talk about this, because this would be stretching beyond your area of expertise, but what do you think the implications are for social policy and social interventions in the long term? And, you know, I know this is going to be speculative, and this is, you know, not an official recommendation to any governmental agency, but what do you see in the future?
I think that, I mean, it's known already that the socioeconomic milieu plays a very big role in the determining the fate of people. If you are born in a poor environment with non-educated parents, violent parents, the chance that you will reproduce this and not be able to make it in life is high. So in terms of policy, maybe be more aware of the influence of the environment, and that whatever social help can be provided to young children should be done. It is done in many countries, but maybe not at the right time, maybe too late, and maybe not the right way. I don't have any recipe, but maybe being aware, more aware of the dramatic consequences of the social milieu early in life. And I think, you know, there is lots of debate about parenting, about the value or what it means to be parent, of adoption or using a artificial, you know, reproductive technologies like sperm donation and so on. I think people are wasting time to discuss this type of issues. They should rather discuss what does a child really need and what should be avoided in a child's environment to not perpetuate the consequences of detrimental or not favorable environments. and that it doesn't matter whether this is the biological parents or not.
Yeah, I often think that if we could really do right by our children, and our meaning the whole world, that there would be a lot less conflict in the world. There'd still be some, because for you know, there, not everything is reducible to psychology, but there's an awful lot of pain in the world that doesn't need to be. And I think that your work is helping to eventually address this pain and to help to reduce it. So I really thank you for your research and your efforts. And it's clear that you have a passion for it and a vision of how it can be so very, very helpful.
Many thanks for your interest. That was a very interesting interview. Thank you.
Yeah, so thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.